This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In this second hour of the show, we'll be talking about the issue of police misconduct in the city of Chicago and perhaps try to extend the frame a little bit more than that and talk about the issue generally of police conduct or misconduct in big departments across the country and how citizens can address that. According to a recent report that was put together by a legal team at the University of Chicago, police officers in that city are subject to more brutality complaints per officer than the national average. This report concludes that the city of Chicago has a broken system for monitoring and disciplining its officers. We'll try to talk a little bit about the report, what that says about Chicago, but also what can be done to improve police accountability in communities across the country. And our guest for the program is Craig Futterman. He is a clinical professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Before he went to Chicago in 2007, he was the director of public interest programs and lecturer in law at Stanford. After his graduation from law school, he worked as a trial attorney in the juvenile division of the Cook County Public Defender's Office, and then after that worked in a Chicago law firm that concentrated on complicated federal litigation. And In that capacity, he specialized in civil rights lawsuits focusing on matters involving police brutality and racial discrimination. So this is an area that he's been working in for some time now. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. Questions and comments are welcome. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be as brief as they can. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. Your participation in the show is welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, could be up in the city of Chicago. If you're listening on the Internet in the U.S., you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Futterman, hello.
Hi, good morning, David. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Let's do the headline here again on what it is that you found. Basically, that when you take a look at police departments the size of Chicago, and it is the second biggest, only New York City is bigger, and you look at what the average is for excessive force complaints, how does Chicago stack up against any other big city?
Well, with respect to excessive force complaints in particular, Chicago officers per officer, there's a much greater, amass a much greater number of brutality complaints than their counterparts around the nation. But more, probably more importantly, with respect to excessive force complaints, the data about how Chicago addresses excessive force complaints is even more telling. The likelihood that a brutality or excessive force complaint will be sustained in Chicago is 94% less likely than virtually anywhere else in the nation, any other large metropolitan police department in the nation, 94% less likely. So what our study found, first and foremost, was that the Chicago systems for supervising and disciplining its officers were utterly broken.
And just to take it a little bit further, indeed, you looked at not just excessive force complaints, but a number of complaints, issues of people who were alleging that that officers behaved in a way that showed they were displaying a variety of kinds of bias, particularly bias against people of color. So if you add on just a wide range of misconduct complaints, it seemingly gets even worse.
Yeah, to be clear, I can give you a little bit of background on the type of data that we were looking at in Chicago. Over a recent six-year period, we obtained data, and this all the data to be clear, also came directly from, this isn't our data, but the City of Chicago, the police department's own data. Mm. We looked at what we considered to be five of the most serious forms of civilian abuse, those being excessive force, brutality, illegal searches, false arrests, i.e. planting evidence on people, racial abuse, and sexual abuse. And we obtained data for each and every complaint brought over a recent six-year period and wanted to see what happened with those complaints. How were they addressed? Were they sustained? What percent were sustained? And what happened as a result? Was any discipline at all or any meaningful discipline imposed? And the first thing that we found when we looked at all of those complaints, those, you know, the serious forms of complaints, that the odds that a Chicago police officer would receive any meaningful discipline for a charge of serious civilian abuse was less than 2 in 1,000. Mm-hmm. Less than 2 in 1,000 when we looked at those numbers. And, you know, so we tried also then to, you know, compare Chicago's numbers to national numbers, compare Chicago's numbers also over time, because one of the stark things also was that that at the same time when Chicago officials were speaking of reforms and harken back, there was an infamous period of police torture that occurred in interrogation rooms more than a decade ago and went on for about 2 decades, and it led by a commander by the name of John Burge that became infamous in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And there have been international human rights reports, and it's been found by various federal courts, human rights agencies, et cetera, to be a fact now. And so what officials frequently said was sort of, that was then, this is now. And what we tried to look at, you know, have the underlying conditions that allowed Burge and his henchmen to torture black men with impunity in these interrogation chambers, and this involved things like electroshock, I mean, horrible stuff, have those underlying conditions really changed? And one of the interesting things that the data showed, rather than, you know, that was then, this is now, things are getting better, was that the sustained rate, the rate that the department actually found that these brutality complaints had any merit, was precipitously going down. So from 1999, the sustained rate was an already low just 5%. But by 2004, the sustained rate for a brutality complaint was less than 0.5%. Less than 0.5%. And so you had about a 90% decline, and it wasn't just two anomalous years, but between 1999 and 2004, every year it precipitously went down. And then we also, as you said, compared this to national data to see how Chicago stacked up. And one of the things that we also did, at least some eyeballing, was we looked at the departments that had been in trouble with the United States Department of Justice, departments that the Department of Justice found had engaged in a pattern and practice of civil rights violations of excessive force and failure to appropriately address them. And with the exception of Cleveland, Chicago made what the U.S. DOJ had already found to be the worst of the worst. Chicago's data made those departments often look like angels. Mm. Those were some of the things that the data showed.
Maybe we want to make now, and I don't want to undercut the idea that there is a very serious system problem here in the way that complaints are addressed. But at the same time, I think we want to make the point that at least that the officers that are accused of this kind of behavior doing this, it's a small number of individuals that is not this behavior that is doing this is not widespread in the department among its officers. And now again, we've got a problem with how these complaints are addressed, but the people that are doing this were found to be really a rather small percentage of the department's officers.
The good news, and this is true, the good news, what the data showed was that 80% of the police force were not amassing extraordinary numbers of complaints. So we didn't see a picture of a police force that was corrupt, brutal, racist through and through. That's not what the data showed. But the data also didn't show, because so typically, though, And what's been uncritically accepted, you know, there's always going to be a few bad apples. And, you know, so that there's always going to be a few. And that's, you know, and the problem has typically been attributed to just a few bad apples. And the data also didn't support that as well. What the data showed was that it's not simply a few bad apples, but that the department had allowed this small percent, or these so-called few bad apples, to abuse people in certain communities with impunity. Because one of the things also that the data also made clear, that Chicago's data made clear, was that police abuse in Chicago was not an equal opportunity phenomenon. Mm-hmm. These complaints weren't equally or randomly distributed throughout the city, but that they were committed, or the charges were brought against certain officers in certain police units with certain supervisors, and most importantly, certain victims, involving certain victims in certain parts of the city, and meaning that police abuse or police abuse complaints were concentrated first and foremost in lower income, black and brown, African American, Latino areas in the, of the city. And so while on the whole, it's very true, on the whole what we found was that less than 5% of the force was responsible for nearly half of all of the serious abuse complaints in the city of Chicago, less than 5%. But in a large, also in a large department, less than 5% isn't a small number of officers. It actually was about 660 officers. But those 660 officers, as I said, weren't evenly or equally distributed, so that you had many areas of the city, and we actually looked, when we looked at the distribution of complaints, we focused on the officers who amassed the most, and we picked a high bar, officers who had amassed 11 or more official misconduct complaints just within the last 5 years. And we wanted to see where those, and we call them repeaters, where those repeaters were located. And we found, though, that so while in many areas of the city there were zero or one, I mean, so you had units of 400 officers and no repeaters, or very few. And then you had areas like public housing on the south side of Chicago, an almost 100% African-American community, where these repeaters, officers who had amassed 11 or more official misconduct complaints just within the last 5 years, made up nearly 20%, one in five, of the entire unit. So for if you lived in public housing on the south side, it wasn't a few bad apples. You had these repeaters who may be the face of the police department for you. Mm-hmm. Whereas in other communities, that's right. That it was by far the exception. So the other part of the good news is that it really makes solving, or at least some of the problem, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit since it's smaller number of officers and in clumps, in groups, in certain areas of the city, we know where we should be looking, and what the study showed, and when we talked to police officials, that became even more damning, was that the admission that no one was looking at this, that there was really a concerted attempt not to know about our problems, our bad apples, and where they were, which amounted, at least in our view, to more than just a mere indifference. And that was really the heart of the problem, not that you had a wildly corrupt department through and through, but that a small percentage, but that's still a lot of officers, allowed to abuse people in lower-income black and brown communities with impunity, knowing that nothing's going to happen. Mm.
Do you, this obviously is a speculative question, although you may have some data to use to answer a question like this, but do you think that if we went to other large cities, Los Angeles, New York, Cleveland, Atlanta, you know, you name Miami, you name your city, and we look closely in the way that you did, do you think that in fact you might well find something similar?
Yeah, well, the issue of both racism and racism, particularly in the criminal justice system, is not just a Chicago phenomenon, but a national issue and a national problem. And one of my hopes by our in-depth look at Chicago, which, you know, when we compare it to national data, certainly stands out in ways that aren't to be envied. But at the same point, what we're hoping is that we encourage police departments, law enforcement agencies around the nation, policymakers around the nation to do similar studies because, you know, what we looked at were just the most basic, straightforward data that should be available to all. And, you know, the thing that really struck me and struck my students was that no one was looking at this, not just in Chicago, but even, you know, when we talked with both attorneys and policymakers around the nation, that Chicago wasn't unique in its failure, really, to look at these numbers and do both the self-examination and open itself up for public examination to see what needs to be done. But certainly it's not just a Chicago phenomenon.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest, and then we have a couple of callers we'll bring into the conversation. Our guest is Craig Futterman. He is clinical professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and was one of a team there at Chicago that was involved in putting together this report looking at the Chicago Police Department's broken system, looking at complaints of police misconduct and how it is they were handled. And among other things, they found that police officers in the city of Chicago got more brutality complaints per officer than the national average. They also found that the department there in Chicago is far less likely to produce abuse cases seriously than the norm nationally. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. We'll start with line one, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hello, sir. Professor Fetterman, what do you make of Mayor Daley's recent refusal to release the names of some of the rogue cops in the Chicago Police Department?
Yeah, that's a great question. For folks who don't have a background on this, this list, you know, one of the things that we generated and were able to generate from Chicago data was a list of the officers in Chicago who've amassed the most, who've been charged with the most abuse. So who are the Chicago police officers who've been charged with more abuse in the city of Chicago? And the mayor and his lawyer have fought tooth and nail to keep that information not only from being public, which is, you know, and I'll talk about that, but also, interestingly, have now fought to keep that information from Chicago City Council, which is the legislative body in charge with overseeing the police department. So the city council itself, in addition to the public, are being deprived of the identities and where they work, the units in which these officers work, the officers who've been charged with the most abuse in Chicago. And at the same time, there have been a group of officers who've recently been indicted federally and statewide for having engaged in a pattern and a string of armed robberies, kidnappings, and then ultimately even one of them, a murder for hire. And it's been widely reported in the papers that these officers had a long, long history of complaints, but nothing had ever been done. And so the obvious question is, why don't we want both the public and the city agency that's in charge with overseeing the police department to know about the special operations type crews and these birds type crews before they have an opportunity to engage in murder for hire? So the bad news there is, I think, also because at the same time in which the mayor has talked about major reforms, enhancing openness and accountability, this is an area in which actions speak louder than words. And the actions are, while talking openness and accountability, hiding from the public just who are the officers who've been charged with the most abuse. And, you know, I guess the thing I also want to say about who the officers who are charged with the most abuse and just the deep public interest in this, you know, we need to trust, and I'm a strong believer in this, we need to trust our police department and our officers with a heck of a lot of powers. They need to have the power to make arrests, to take people's liberty. They need to have the power to use force and even at times to shoot people when it's appropriate, to protect all of us. But with those powers come a real accountability and responsibility to the public. And so when we're talking about not what officers do in their private lives, or where they live, or whether they showed up to work late. But when they've been charged with official misconduct on the basis of their jobs and their public duties and these awesome powers, that's just something that we all have a deep interest in, and particularly in light of the city's failure to address this for oh so many years, that the underlying conditions that have allowed these crews to get away with this still haven't been corrected, all the more important that this information is publicly available.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is also Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Hi. That's absolutely fascinating. Professor Futterman, I'm wondering if there... Well, let me put it this way. I believe there's a culture of acceptance in Chicago that allows for corruption in many different departments, including the police. Do you think that culture can be changed, given how deeply rooted it is into the psyche of so many people in Chicago? And a second question, have you been adversely affected by doing this study in any way? Thank you.
Thanks. Well, to the first question, I wouldn't even engage in this work if I didn't have a belief and optimism that things can change. Otherwise, this work would be fruitless. So while I agree there's been a long and sordid history in Chicago, I'm an optimist by nature, and I'm hopeful that by putting information like this out there, by educating the public by this public discourse, that we demand this change and that change can occur, and I'm hopeful that we're actually seeing it. But at the same time, of course, you know, there's a reason to be skeptical because, and you're talking about Chicago, this isn't the first police scandal in Chicago, and there have been many over the last 20, 30 or more years. And most times when there's a scandal, our public officials say all the right things. There'll be a thorough investigation. No stone will go unturned. We may form a commission. Some heads will roll. Just within the last 10 to 15 years, we've changed the head of the agency that investigates police more than 5 times. But it comes down to a question of political will. Is the political will there now to address finally the fundamental problems that have plagued the system for oh so much time? And my hope, and I can only be hopeful by putting this information out there, and that others will use and demand this, as well as our policymakers in the city, that you know that this is the right time, and that meaningful change can indeed will occur. It's a time also in this administration where, you know, I hope, while there's, you know, been a lot of evidence to the contrary over the years, I hope that this pressure will cause this administration to respond, and while he's in his later part of his administration, to think about, first and fundamentally, what needs to be done to correct these problems? What needs to be done to enhance public safety, to enhance public confidence, and to eliminate abuse of the most vulnerable in our society, to eliminate this system of corruption? I'm also sympathetic, though. I do want to say to, you know, folks, it also implies, you know, issues of a code of silence that have also been a part of not just the police department in Chicago, but that's also a national phenomenon. And if we're going to be straight, codes of silence exist not just in police departments, but in other areas. And, you know, the problem is, and I'll tell one story. There was a time in which my students and I were out, and we were in public housing, and we saw, or my students saw, I saw the tail end of this, but we saw with our own eyes this police car slam into an older man who was riding his bicycle through, and then when they got out of the car, he was pinned between the fence. The driver beat him, and beat him in front of nearly 100 people, and there were other officers who were also on the scene. One of the things we saw in terms of the officers' response, some of the officers on the scene, there actually was like a melee between the officers. Like, you know, you're making all of us look bad. How could you do this in this community? How could you do this? We have to work here each and every day. But when I talked to those officers privately, and many of them who meant well, wanted to do the right thing, knew that they could never come forward and say what they saw publicly, or their career would be over as an officer, their life may be in jeopardy. I mean, the consequences are real. So one of the things, as you said, as this caller said, is there really needs to be a change of culture within the department. It starts from above. It's a paramilitary organization where you set the tone from on high, so there needs to be the will there. But then this abuse, it hurts the vast majority of good officers who want to do nothing but protect and serve. And so we also need, at the line level, the cultural to shift that officers are saying, we're not going to tolerate you few who are abusive, who are making our jobs harder, hurting public safety and giving us a bad name. And rather than go after the whistleblower, we're going to go after those abusers because we're not going to tolerate this. And there are officers who really care about that. In Chicago, there's an organization called the African American Police League that are made up of officers who care about these very issues. And, you know, and I hope that also this information empowers officers, not just community members, to demand the change to make all of us safer.
Let me introduce again the guest, Greg Futterman. He's clinical professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Before that, he taught at Stanford. After he graduated law school, he worked as a trial attorney in the juvenile division of the Cook County Public Defender's Office, and then he was an attorney in a Chicago law firm that concentrated on federal litigation. And when he was there, he specialized in civil rights lawsuits, focusing on matters involving police brutality and racial discrimination. And he was one of a team that produced a recent report. It was released about the middle of November, looking at the problem of police misconduct in the city of Chicago and the way that it was handled by the police department there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There are many communities around the country where they have citizen review panels that sit to hear reports of police misconduct, and the city of Chicago, it's my understanding, does not have one. You, I think, are among those who have advocated that such a thing be created for Chicago.
Yeah, well, the way in which Chicago police abuse complaints are investigated, there are two tracks. One track has been historically for excessive force or brutality complaints, and they go to a police department agency called the Office of Professional Standards, which has been historically a part of the police department, but staffed by civilian employees. And they investigate, they make recommendations that then are subject to review within the police department, with the superintendent making the final call, but still subject to some appellate rights by the officers themselves. Then the other half of, all other categories of corruption, illegal search, etc., is handled typically by an internal affairs, sort of the IAD, IAB, which most folks are familiar with, and often investigated by Chicago police officers in the sense investigating themselves. Now, in theory, I think that police abuse complaints can be competently and professionally investigated by a police department with some civilian input, review, and oversight. But the problem in Chicago is just that there, and the data show this, that this has been an agency that has been proven incapable of policing itself. One of the things that I didn't mention, David, is that we didn't just look at the numbers, too. We actually looked at a large sample of investigative files, the actual files, so we could see how investigations, you know, what explains these 2 in 1,000 or 2 in 10,000 numbers, mm-hmm. That in which nothing happens. And so we looked at the files themselves to see how are these complaints actually investigated. And what we found, was that if we investigated crime, civilian crime, the way we investigate police abuse in Chicago, we just wouldn't close a case. Virtually every canon of professional investigations were violated routinely in the police abuse investigations that we looked at. And we just looked at a random sample, most serious categories. To make that concrete, imagine a rape or a beating takes place. Victim identifies her attacker. The detectives then wait weeks or months before they even attempt to contact the suspect. And when they do, they send the alleged perpetrator a written form and saying, here's the substance of the allegations, here's the name of the witnesses, the time, the place, the circumstances, etc. And then the department tells the accused, take a week, sometimes two, three, or more weeks, and just file one paragraph denial of the charges, which is then accepted without question whether the accused has talked to anyone, you know, to get their statements together. And this isn't a hypothetical aberrational practice. This was what we saw as CPD's standard procedures in investigating police abuse complaints. In more than 85% of, these are the serious police abuse charges, more than 85% of the cases, the charged officer was never interviewed on the phone or face-to-face in person. And in many of the remaining 15%, the department determined that the complaint was not sustained without even contacting any law enforcement officer on the scene. We saw that it was a rare event when an officer would actually go to the scene and investigate a case. It's just your basic canons of professional investigation. I mean, how do you investigate any crime? Incident occurs, you go to the scene, you get to the scene as promptly as possible. First thing you do then is protect the scene. Protect physical evidence, collect it, test it, try to identify, canvas the area for potential witnesses, try to identify who they are, and then talk to witnesses face-to-face separately so that their memories aren't tainted, less opportunities for collusion. And when you talk to people face-to-face or even over the phone, David, as you are with me, you can ask follow-up questions. Like, so if something that I say doesn't make sense, you can ask a follow-up question and clarify. You can compare what I say to other things you know in the world. You can compare what I say to other witnesses. And this is just Investigations 101. Each and every one of those things that we just talked about, they don't even go to the scene, or they rarely ever go to the scene, much less collect physical evidence, which is routinely destroyed. Even police records, like 911 tapes related to the police abuse incidents, were more often than not destroyed and not preserved as a part of these investigations. So when we looked at the actual procedures, it left little wonder why 998 out of every 1,000 complaints led to nearly nothing.
We have a couple of other callers here. We want to get them in as we're moving into about our last 20 minutes of the program, maybe more like 15. The next caller is in line number 3, I believe, and that is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Professor Fitterman, when I was a very young man in the early 60s, I was a caseworker for Cook County Department of Public Aid in Cabrini Green. And not only did I witness police brutality, but I also had difficulty in getting the police out of the Chicago Avenue police station when my client was being threatened. There was no aggressive policing there when somebody needed help in Cabrini Green. But what I wanted to ask you, I later became an academic, and I have written about this, these issues. And in Paul Chivigny's book, The Comparative Study of the New York and Los Angeles Police Departments, what he found was in the police academies themselves, police were instructed into how to cover themselves when there had been abuses, in fact, how to lie about what went on in the situation. And, of course, this led to both the code of silence and, when people did talk, to perjuring themselves as to what had really happened. And very often the victim would then be charged with a crime.
That's right. Those are all data points which are also could be, you know, there are certain also cover charges that stand out that could be collected if you start seeing certain officers routinely filing these things. But go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
But no, that's fine. My question is, has there been any kind of reform in the police training academies themselves? Has there been an attempt to develop an ethos which runs against this kind of silence or lying in the Chicago Academy? I don't know anything about Chicago
Sure.
Academy or in other academies nationally. And by the way, the question that we're talking about is not only a national question, it's an international question. In England and in France, the same problems exist.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, the short answer is I haven't deeply studied I have reviewed training curriculum, but I haven't. This study did not deeply look into Chicago Police Department Training Academy. Certain things, and I know that that's something that they're continually trying to review and revise how they train their officers. The pen and paper parts of, you know, what we did review, and not as a part of this study, but what I have reviewed in the past, often doesn't look terrible. So the first part of what you're learning in the classroom, and there are segments on issues of professionalism, integrity, racial sensitivity, multiculturalism, etc. That's a part of standard police classroom training. But what's also part, also as you mentioned, is there is training on how to testify, and some have noted, and there have been articles about this, they call it test-a-line at times, but, you know, how to present yourself as a witness. But the second part, and probably the most important part of training in Chicago, is then, so you have the first part in school, but then you work under what they call a field training officer in the field. And the problem is, what's happened in the field then is ignore, you know, that, you know, so where the written policy says, do this, treat everybody, good. That what's shown in the field and by example is this is how you police in the real world. And that does much more to undermine even the good things that are taught in the academy. But I haven't done any systematic study of police training in Chicago, but I think that's appropriate to do, and not just appropriate, but incredibly important to do.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This would be in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yeah. Let's even step back even further. They were talking about training. In the, you know, the recruitment of these officers, it seems to me that there's a certain segment that have a propensity to be abusive.
Right.
I know that I used to live in the Chicago area, and I was talking to a police chief in a suburban area, and one of the biggest problems he had was that a lot of them never passed the psychological testing.
Right.
It seems to me that the psychological testing ought to even be bring out this dimension. If you find that this, you know, person came from an abusive family, or what is it signals this thing? So I think that there ought to be something looked at there. I don't know whether it has or not.
Yeah, they do in Chicago do psychological screening, and one of the interesting things, and I saw some of the screenings years ago, and I haven't seen them, and they've actually they set it up in a way now so that the department itself, and this is interesting because they don't want to know, just gets a thumbs up, thumbs down, no report, because the fear was, I think, that if they got the full report, that lawyers and others might be able to discover it at some point in time. So they made the testing completely confidential and just a thumbs up, thumbs down. So we don't really know what kind of testing goes on and what it shows, but when I look back at least at a little bit of the testing and some of the reports, some of the interesting things were red flags that appeared to show up in the testing in some instances, officers were hired anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't speak so much about current practice, and that data. And the biggest reason is the data just simply isn't available. Not just because it's deemed to be private, but that the police department itself doesn't want to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. We now have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Craig Futterman. He's clinical professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and was involved in the report that we've mentioned a couple of times on the Chicago Police Department's broken system, looking at charges of police misconduct and then how internally those were handled by the department. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How now has the, this obviously is something that has to be responded to at the highest level of the Chicago Police and Chicago City Government. It's certainly not something that they can, I don't think, easily brush aside because, as you pointed out, you use their own data about complaints and then, you looked at the number of complaints and then you looked at the number of disciplinary actions. So right there would be something that would have to be addressed. How has the senior leadership of the Chicago Police Department responded to this?
Well, the response has largely been one of we recognize that we have problems, but the problems have been defined as problems of public perception, and rather than a willingness to fundamentally look at what the problems are, what the underlying problems are, and then try to devise solutions. You know, devise a cure that fits the diagnosis of what's wrong. What's gone on here have been largely solutions or reforms and pronouncements that are designed to fix a PR problem, since that's how it's been defined. What we really need to do is reestablish trust, faith, and confidence. Concretely, some of the things that have been done, and I'm glad that there are actions that are being done. So this special operations team that now everyone knows has been running amok for years and abusive, it's been disbanded. That's certainly a good thing, but it also disbanded, and many of the officers then though just sent to other units. That also, though, doesn't address, though, the fundamental underlying problem, which is, hey, this unit could have been identified by us. I mean, so when we looked at, actually, this is a good point, when we looked at, it's not just individual officers, but groups of officers, and there were just certain units that would just jump off the page, and it was a couple keystrokes at a computer would easy to see. But the fundamental fixes haven't been now, since there are units, groups of officers, and abuse tends also to be a group phenomenon. An officer can't just get away with it by him or herself, but works with partners, works in teams, and just about every major police scandal, not just in Chicago but around the nation, doesn't involve one officer but involves a group or a team of officers, so it makes it all the more easy to identify. That stuff just hasn't been done or taken on. So there have been the pronouncements of, we're going to overhaul our investigative system. We'll bring in a new head of a new head to investigate police abuse. And I have every reason to believe that the new head is well-intentioned. But this has been the solution five times in the last 15 years. And unless there's the political will, which is where we started the conversation, the political will that starts from the mayor's office at the highest city levels to give the head of OPS or the new police superintendent, and they're in the process of trying to confirm a new police superintendent in Chicago, with the power to address these issues and to first acknowledge these issues and then devise solutions that go directly to the problems. We're just going to have, another scandal 5 years from now and be having the same conversation. So there have been some public moves, but they've been more thus far designed to address a PR problem. I think the city really needs to take and internalize this information, this data, and acknowledge we have real problems that have allowed innocent people to be abused for too long, that have really done great harm to the vast majority of our officers who are out there putting their necks on the line each and every day for all of us. And we need to just address this and take a look at what those problems are and address those problems squarely and directly.
All right. Let's talk again with another caller in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you know much about Champaign, but right now we don't have a police review board. And as well, the mayor of the town used to be the police chief or sheriff or something, so he's not really going to push for that. I was wondering if you have any suggestions for how maybe to push for those kinds of actions that you're talking about, the changes, just in a town like Champaign.
I think it starts with openness and transparency. So it starts with, I don't know, I'm not in a position to say whether there are or are not problems with police accountability in Champaign, but it starts with looking at some of the same things that we looked at. Let's look at and make public police misconduct complaints, the non-private information related to them. Let's look at where it's occurring, how much it's occurring, and how the department has addressed this from an accountability perspective. And then when we're operating on information, on open information, then, you know, we can have a public conversation about what, if anything, needs to be done. Is Champaign doing a great job? Are they doing largely a good job, but here are a couple things that need to be worked on? Or are there some fundamental issues that really need to be reexamined? But I think it starts, though, with getting the information and so that both the public, policymakers, and police department are operating. I mean, that's the value of this show. I think it's a value of the media.
Well, my wife just happens to be doing a study just really close to what you're doing, and I was wondering if maybe she could get a panel or some kind of like time on the radio to, she has these kinds of findings for Champaign, if we could, you know, have that airspace. That would be incredible to be able to show these findings.
Well, we could certainly talk about that. You should get in touch with our news director, Tom Rogers, and maybe also we could talk about that as well on this program, too, because it's certainly, as you say, we thought it would be interesting to do this program and talk about Chicago, but we don't simply want to talk about Chicago. And obviously, as we've talked about in this discussion, this is not just a kind of a Chicago problem, and it's a problem you see in a lot of places around the country.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Just, I'm going back, just curious about, you know, your feeling about how it is that the senior leadership of the Chicago Police Department feel about this issue, whether they feel that it's not a big issue, or they feel that it is an issue, a significant issue, but involving a small number of people, and that they are very concerned about how people will feel generally about the police. So for that reason, they wouldn't be happy to have this kind of publicity, or they wouldn't want to be happy to have a lot of police officers disciplined. And it wouldn't be because they didn't think that they had a problem, but that it goes back to this other thing, that what they really want to really do is keep a lid on it so that you maintain as much as possible people's relatively positive feelings about the department as a whole.
Yeah, well, definitely all again that we can judge by the public actions, and what we've seen in Chicago has been the desire not to know and keep a lid on things. So the infamous videos that have been seen around the world of, say, the couple bar beatings where the woman was, one in which the woman was beaten by that off-duty officer, shown across the world. And there was another that involved recently four Chicago businessmen who were beaten in a bar, and this again was caught on videotape. The official response, though, and the knee-jerk reaction whenever an incident like that occurs has been to circle the wagons, so that those videotapes actually were suppressed for months, even though the department had them. And also, not only were the videotapes suppressed, but no actions were taken with respect to any of those officers until then those videotapes were leaked by folks outside the department, which forced public hands. Same thing when that officer was then going to court, the one who beat the woman on videotape. It was high levels of police command who set up officers to try to keep all media away, to keep the public from knowing. Similarly, whenever there is a high profile or high publicity incident of police abuse, there is a public relations, public affairs team on the scene almost, but immediately, that invariably puts out the statements that this was a justifiable use of force, a justifiable shooting. You don't see it to the contrary. So I guess the public reaction or the public response by high level of command has been protect the department, circle the wagons. And what's deeply needed in Chicago, and I'm sure it's, again, not just a Chicago issue, but is a contrary response from police leadership, which is, we want to get to the truth, We want to protect the public, and we want to be sure that there is a fair investigation, but an aggressive, thorough, and competent investigation to find out what really happened. And if there was abuse, we need to get rid of these folks. If there are systemic conditions that have allowed this to occur, as what we've been finding and seeing, just, you know, the openness and brazenness in which officers have been allowed to act in certain communities like public housing or poorer black and brown communities, that then that you have from the top officials who are committed to taking those issues on and addressing them directly.
Yeah, we're unfortunately at the time where we can't really talk very much further, but just in about 30 seconds, have people been successful in pursuing action, legal action against the city and against the police department?
Yeah, so there have been the city has paid out, this was actually just reported, the city's paid out over the last 5 years, I believe, $121 million as a result of police abuse lawsuits. And that doesn't even account for the probably at least as much that they've paid defending those suits and paying sometimes private firms to defend against such litigation. That's just the payouts in both settlements and jury awards. And but the problem again has been, and I think that matters, and that matters a lot, is it's more than, you know, the bad news that's costed taxpayers, sure, and all of us millions of dollars as well, is that they've paid out the money in those settlements and lawsuits, but yet those very same officers remain on the force, continue to carry badges and guns, and so the problems don't get corrected. And the other thing that, it's not just an internal then city issue, but our officials, our local prosecutors and federal prosecutors also have responsibilities to step in and set the tone, because certainly when then other officers see that real abuse isn't going to be tolerated in a paramilitary organization, that government officials are going to address and intervene, it's going to affect behavior. But as long as folks know, or officers know, the bad ones know, that they can get away with this with impunity, and they can get money, they can take money from drug dealers, they can run their own scams, and know that nothing's going to happen to them, it's just not going to be stopped. The code of silence isn't something that needs to be addressed, both at the ground level, but starting from the top.
Yeah. Greg Futterman is our guest. He's clinical professor of law at University of Chicago. By the way, the report, if you'd like to read it, is available there on the website of the law school there at University of Chicago, so you can take a look at it. Professor Futterman, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with your listeners.